to the second hour of Shattering Myths. We still have Will with us because really the topic of conversation isn't going to change. We are going to continue to focus on Yahweh, his testimony. One of the questions that I asked Will before the break is, what were some of the things that triggered you to question your religion? One of the things that struck me also, Will, as you were speaking of that, is remember earlier, I think it was actually last week, that we received a couple of calls from a fellow Bentley who referred to himself as a Jesus guy. And when I quoted what I think is among Yosha's most profound statements, and it's in the midst of a very long treatise on the importance of the Torah, in his single most important public presentation, which is called the Sermon on the Mount. And I asked him, so how is it possible that the way can be narrow and few that find it to life, and the way is broad and popular and many find it to death and destruction? And how can it be possible that Christianity at 2.2 billion adherents can be the way under those circumstances? And his response was, you know, I really don't know what he said. Well, how can you be a Jesus guy if you don't know his name and you don't know what he said? And that's really the crux of all of this, is that the proponents of Christians have no idea whatsoever of who Yahusha is, what he did, what he said, why he was here. They don't know him. And if they were to come to know him and find out that he was a diminished manifestation of the very God they dislike, whose Torah they dismiss and disdain, they wouldn't care for him at all.
Speaker right now, is that interfering with the volume?
No, that's okay. Go ahead. We'll try. Okay. So you were speaking about the triggers, and one of the first triggers was this realization that Christians actually don't have an affinity for their Jesus, the real Yahusha. They don't know him very well at all. They have an affinity for Paul.
Yep.
And Paul's letters are diametrically opposed to Yahweh's teaching. So that tells you a great deal about them, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So what other things along the way caused you to question your affinity?
Well, this is funny. I bet this pastor, if he knew, would be just having a tizzy fit. I used to watch him on TV for a long time. Never paid him really any money till one time I did. His name is Pastor Frederick Price out of California. You might have heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he always stressed, you got to read this word. You got to read this word. You got to read this word every day. And I started listening to him, and I started reading it and learned out he is full of just like every one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's interesting. Humor, my mocking side. I know Yah does mock people who think they can fight with him, you know, to a point. Even though he wants them to come to redemption, they say it's really silly. What are you doing?
Yeah. I don't think you can actually fight with God. I think you can wrestle with him. You know, if you're going to oppose him, it's not going to turn out well. But if you're going to struggle with him and wrestle with him and kind of do the stuff that we do in life, you know, we, even with our own children and with our parents, we at times wrestle with them and struggle with them. And God has no concern, in fact, actually favors this idea of wrestling with him and struggling in our relationship with him from time to time. That's why Yisrael is named Yisrael. You know, Sarah, the basis of Yisrael, Israel means individual, Yish. Sarah, who struggle, who strive, who contend with. And then El is the title for God. And so God doesn't really have any issue with us struggling with him from time to time. But opposing him, you know, that's an entirely different story.
Yeah, it's a different ballgame.
Doesn't the struggling with him also provide a different point of view? Like, doesn't it show him that you're still using your free will and your ability to question things?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I totally agree that the very nature of Yisrael, and Sarah, by the way, is also more important than just as the crux of the name Yisrael. It's also the mother of the covenant. You know, it was Sarah and Abraham. And so what Sarah says is that by struggling and wrestling with God, that we're engaged in a relationship. But that's what it says. And again, God, you're right. It underscores two aspects of the relationship. One is free will, that we're not to kowtow and obey, but instead wrestle with these concepts and come to use our free will to and our ability to discern between right and wrong, good and bad, to choose what we wish to embrace. It does underscore free will. It also underscores the nature of a family relationship as opposed to the religious concept of worshiper and God. You, if you were to wrestle with the God of religion, you'd be smitten. But you can wrestle with your dad. It's an entirely different perspective, and it's one that helps define the nature of the covenant. So you've shared some of the things that caused you to walk away from religion, Will. What was it that caused you to embrace what Yahweh was saying? When you came to know who God is and what he was offering by turning to the Word and studying his testimony, what was it in his Word that resonated with you and say, wow, I like the God that I'm coming to know here, and I trust what he is offering. Is there anything in particular that resonated with you in this way?
Well, actually, the whole thing, all his words resonate quite well with me. But one thing that really blows my mind studying these more ancient writings that are so old, they're the oldest known writings, is that he does explain that his universe is expanding. And what you were stating, that our science recently, not too long ago, has just been discovering this with, you know, the Hubble telescope. But like you said, they didn't know this stuff then. And here's a creator saying who I am and explaining this to you, that I already know this, and explaining to you, tells me he's real. He yeah. proves himself everything through his words. He does not contradict. When I read the Matthew of the Hebrew Matthew, where he tells to do as Moses did, but do not do as they do, because they don't even do what they say to do. And you heard a totally different thing in the English translation that contradicts itself, but in the Hebrew and the ancient writings, it don't contradict. That tells you do what Moses did, because I gave him this Torah. I wrote it. I told him what to write. This is who I am.
Right.
And it never contradicts.
Yeah, it strikes me that you've focused on the two things that resonated with me. The first of those things was prophecy, and every aspect of his testimony relative to those things that have occurred over time. You know, for example, when you examine the creation account with an understanding of science and particularly relativity, and they understand what we have learned through the microwave background radiation and the stretching of that wavelength, what you recognize is that 6 creative days transpire over just shy of 16 billion years. And that is what is telling us that God's timeline is precisely accurate. And what you learn is that every day, each new era of creation, that the things he said happened exactly that way and exactly that order. But then you move on and you examine the countless predictions that he has made and how precise they are of human history as it will unfold. And you find that if you run the odds on chance fulfillment of these things, you, by the time you've covered some 25 or 30 prophecies, you get to the point where the chance fulfillment is 1 in 10 to a power that exceeds the number of fundamental particles in the entire universe. But once you do that, and you now recognize that God has absolutely proved his existence, and that he has proved that he authored his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, which is profound in itself, that isn't the thing that resonates the most strongly with those who observe his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It isn't the proof that he exists. It's instead the elegance and the beauty and the consistency of the story that he tells. It's how everything fits together. Nothing contradicts anything. And the deeper you look, the more magnificent it becomes. It's the quality of the writing, the depth of the story that he is telling, that ultimately is what causes us to know him and fall in love with him.
Yeah. I tell you, reading his word, and my wife says, gosh, you read a lot of this. I said, well, yes, I want to know who he is. And I learn more and more. And it's like after reading, and I read out loud so my ears will hear it too.
Right.
My brain feels like I just did about, 10,000 push-ups.
Yes.
I get so tight, and I feel relaxed. I sleep so good at night too, better than I ever have, because he's restful. He gets you to think and get to know him. And it is so peaceful. I love it.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why he says, as often as he says, I want you to shamar, observe my Torah, which means to focus on it, to closely examine it and carefully consider it. Just as often he will say, I want you to shama my word. And to shama is to listen to him. And the only way you can listen to God is to recite his teaching out loud. If you recite his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, which he mostly speaks in first person, out loud, your ears get to hear God's voice.
And every time I do that, I cry. I mean, just about every time, I just shed tears.
Yeah, it is tears of joy. It's an amazing perspective, an amazing opportunity, an amazing voyage.
When I'm crying, I feel a lot of different, joys. I feel joy all at the same time, but I also feel swindled.
Yeah.
These pastors and all this stuff. I always tell them, I say out loud, geez, yeah, I've been hoodwinked. I've been hornswoggled.
Yeah.
I've been lied to.
And in that,
I'm so grateful that you have been so patient with me.
Yeah. And that,
so
by the way,
he simply replies that because you never gave up on him. I never gave up on him. Looking for him.
It is one of the things that that is the emotions that run through all of us once you come out of religion and politics and you come to embrace the covenant and Yahweh at the center of the covenant as Father, is an anger that is born and bred out of the realization that the words of the pastors who are telling us to trust them, who are telling us that they are speaking for God, are lying. That their words are not in sync with Yahweh's testimony. In fact, they're in opposition to Yahweh's testimony. And we'll return to my personal experience with that when Shattering Myths returns after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host and tour guide, Yada, but otherwise irrelevant. I'm going to share, though, a little bit of my past because Will has brought up his experiences with the pastors and having discovered when he actually followed a television evangelist's suggestion that he read the Word. When he read the Word, he found that the Word and the pastor's sermons were incomparable, that they were the antithesis of one another, and so he recognized that since the pastor claimed to be speaking on behalf of these words, that the pastor was by necessity lying. That's the only rational and informed conclusion that can be made. I had a period of time in my life where I was very religious. And as a result of that, during my business years, I got to know a number of pastors. One pastor in particular was the founder of the Moral Majority, became the most famous Protestant pastor in the world. His name was Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell is now dead. Jerry Falwell and I spent thousands of hours together, one-on-one. I flew him in my plane to many speaking engagements. I was on his television show. He spent time in my home and in my office, and I spent time with him in his. And one of the things that that Jerry did is preach mainstream Christianity about a Lord Jesus Christ out of the New Testament, emphasizing the letters of Paul. He would have as his biggest fundraiser and festival each year, a play that was put on regarding the importance of Christmas. And the busiest week at his church each year was, of course, Easter week. And so during the latter part of my relationship with Jerry Falwell, I began to do some research relative to a book I was writing called Tea with Terrorists. It was a derivative of my meeting with Al-Qaeda right after 9/11. I met directly with Al-Qaeda, and I asked them why they were killing us. And what they had to say led me on a journey of discovery initially through Islam's scriptures. But since Islam's Quran claims that it affirms the Torah, I began to study the Torah as well. And early in that research, what I found was that virtually everything I had been led to believe by Christian pastors and that had been promoted by Jerry Falwell was inconsistent with God's testimony. And so very early in this process, I wrote 10 to 12 pages, called it a white paper, on the most profound differences between what Jerry was preaching and promoting and what God had to say. For example, God's name isn't the Lord. His name is Yahweh. That the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh isn't Jesus Christ, but instead the Messiah, Yahusha. That God has no affinity for, in fact sees as an abomination, Christmas and Easter, and instead wants us to walk to him on a path that begins at Passover and ends at Tabernacles, which is Sukkah. And that there is no Trinity, according to Scripture, that Yahweh, our God, is one. And I discovered that God does not say, love me or I'm going to torture you in hell, that there aren't just two destinations for human souls. Very early in the process, I learned that the preponderance of human souls simply cease to exist at the end of their mortal lives, and that that a minority of people end up with him in his home, and no religious people do. And so I presented this white paper to him based upon what I had learned, and since most of what I had learned came from the Hebrew scriptures, he asked his foremost Hebrew scholar, the head of his university, to join us for lunch. It lasted, seems like 5 minutes looking back on it, but it was a 4 to 6 hour lunch. And I presented everything that I had learned. At the end of it, Jerry and his PhD, Liberty University that Jerry had founded, they said this: everything that you have reported to us today is true. We won't deny any of it. But if we were to say these things, the people who sit in the pews of our church would go away, and the letters we receive to support this university would no longer arrive. And if you were to say these things, people would label you a kook. He knew the truth. This was a wonderful, fun man to be around. He knew the truth. And yet he deceived everyone who listened to him in person and on television. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're on the line here with Will, and I apologize, Will, for dominating this segment. But
I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, you led me to something that is near and dear to my heart, because as I was writing initially, almost every day with almost every word that I wrote, my relationship with Jerry Falwell was so close. We were such close friends that with every word that I discovered, I had this burning desire in me to share it with my friend Jerry. And the reason I wanted to share it with Jerry, the reason I had this lunch with Jerry, was that because he had such access to the newsmakers of the world, he could appear on any television program and dominate that program for any time he wanted. And I felt that if I could share this with Jerry and convince him that many people through him would come to know that Christianity was false and that God had articulated a way that was distinct from religion for us to engage in a relationship with him. And when Jerry died, before I was able to complete Yada Yah and present it to him in its completed form, I felt, well, I failed. I'm glad it served as a motivation, but I failed in this regard.
I disagree with you on that. I really do. You've told me this story before, and I totally disagree with that. Who did Yahweh give the original Torah to?
A guy who stuttered and said, "I'm not qualified. Find somebody else."
Exactly. So if he wanted to give it to the most popular and the most well-respected person and like the person that had all their stuff together, he would just give it to that person. And so
yeah.
Instead, he gave it to you. And I don't agree with you. I don't think if he came out and said, Christianity's false and we got to go down this path. Christianity is something that is so, people have it so ingrained in them that even if he says that, I think you're only going to get the same amount of people that hear about the Torah now and say to themselves, well, maybe something's true about that. Maybe I should look into this and start to walk down that path. I think you're going to get the same number of people, that one in a million. Yeah, because people, it's just, that's who they are. It's so ingrained in them that that's what they believe, and they don't want it to be questioned.
There is great truth to what you say. It's humbling truth, of course, humbling in a very different way than society would normally look at it. You look also at Abraham, who was the father of the covenant. God could have made a much bigger splash if he had chosen to form his covenant with the king of Babylon, with the Pharaoh of Egypt, for example. But he didn't. He chose just an ordinary guy, and with that ordinary guy named Abram, he said, "Hey, you, ordinary guy, I want to form a relationship with you." He didn't choose to do it through the religious clerics of the day, even the most famous of them, nor the most powerful kings of the day. He said, "Hey, you, ordinary guy." When he wanted to reveal his Torah teaching, he chose a guy who knew that he wasn't qualified, not the guy who was qualified. Part of that is because it's not about the messenger. It's about the message. And the more irrelevant that the messenger becomes, the more the message is what is heard.
Can I add something here real quick?
Sure. Well.
Yeah, and it is about the message, and it's about the one who's given the message too. I mean,
yeah.
I'm talking about the one who wrote it.
Oh, yes.
Him and his message.
Right.
Completely. I agree
right.
with that one.
Right. And so there's a lot of times where I get just kind of a eureka moment as we have these kind of conversations. This moment is one of them because Yahweh and Yahusha mention Moshe quite often. Just as they mentioned Dode quite often. Two of the people that are mentioned the most by Yahweh and Yahusha are Moshe and Dode. And I want to think about that for a moment. You know, Moshe's only real contribution to the Torah is twofold. God dictated the first of it, and he wrote it down and shared it. And then in the Devarim words, based upon what he had learned by listening to God's teaching, Moshe endeavored to explain it to the children of Yisrael. That's Moshe's contribution to the Torah. He wrote it down as a scribe, and then he shared with his people, with those who would listen, what God said so that they might understand it better. And yet, Yahweh always identifies his Torah with Moshe, this man who was a stutterer, this man who knew he wasn't qualified. It's a profound thought, isn't it, that God reveals himself most effectively through not only through choosing to use human implements, but specifically choosing to use flawed human implements. Because it is flawed human implements that say two things about him. That he is in the business of making the flawed great. Now, not great in the world's eyes, great in his eyes. He's in the business of repairing us, of perfecting us, of making us his children, of helping us grow. And so by saying that the conduit of my teaching is going to be this stutterer who had become nothing more than a sheep herder, God is saying, I'm interested in those individuals who recognize they are flawed and want my help to grow, to become better.
I'm about as dull as a butter knife.
Yeah, and then there's a second aspect of this whole thing. If you can take somebody who is visibly flawed, who has issues with their past, issues with their, I mean, Moshe did. He killed a guy in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had lived a double life. He was a Hebrew, and yet he lived as a part of Pharaoh's family. Most likely was a general on behalf of Pharaoh's army. He lived a double life. This guy had a history that made him prone to be criticized. And yet, by using that kind of an individual to reveal something this profound, who is it that we see? Do we see Moshe, or do we see the author of the message? If God can convey something this profound through such a flawed implement, it tells you that he is indeed extraordinary.
Yes.
And that's part of it as well. And it came through Abram choosing a guy who is just an average fella who was not involved in religion, who was not a preacher or a cleric, somebody who was not a king, who was not a general, by choosing someone who did not have wealth, who had essentially nothing. God is saying, my covenant, my family, it's for ordinary people. You know, I really don't have any interest in reaching out to those who are in positions of power and influence. They don't think they need me. They're self-sufficient. They don't need me, and I certainly don't want to be around them. So let's just avoid one another. I'm going to reach out to an ordinary guy. And Abraham was that. If you look now at the legacy of Abraham, which is the covenant, this ordinary guy became extraordinary, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, look at Dode. Ordinary guy, flawed. Man, really flawed. Did a lot of dumb stuff. Also a shepherd, by the way.
Yes.
Look at the legacy that this man, Dode, has left us. He's left us the most insightful, the most stirring, the most enlightening, the most motivating songs ever scribed. His 119th psalm is the ultimate testament as to how you go about observing Yahweh's Torah teaching so as to know who he is and understand what he is offering so that using free will you can embrace it. But Dode was flawed, deeply flawed. And yet, by way of God's teaching, he, like Moshe, like Abraham, became the most enlightened teachers the world has ever known.
Well, they had a true repentive heart, and Yahweh knows this.
Yeah, I don't use the term repentive because it's got you. Yeah, it's got. I don't even think sorrowful is the right term because I don't see that as something that God is soliciting in us. What they had was a willingness to change. And, you know, if you look at the Greek word that is translated repent, it's metanoio, and it means to change one's attitude, one's thinking, one's direction. The Hebrew equivalent of that is shub. And God uses it throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It is what God really wants us to do, is to be willing to change direction when we learn that human institutions are unreliable and that they lead away from him. To change direction instead of walking along with them and with the masses of people. That we walk in the opposite direction and that we walk towards him along the path that he has provided.
Well,
he wants us...
Just get rid of your pride. Admit that you're wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not just that you're wrong, that human institutions are wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And then the second thing is to change your thinking. And it's a profound change to go from embracing the thinking of patriotism and politics and religion and academics in our society and to recognize that that thinking is deeply flawed, that it's irrational. And then to change your thinking so that your thinking is based on the evidence and reason that is provided in Yahweh's Torah, in his guidance to us. So he's asking you to change your direction, change your thinking. And the single most important thing he's asking us to do in Shub, and to the degree that metanoia reflects Shub, just to change your attitude. Change your attitude. You know, there's nothing more debilitating than a bad attitude and nothing more powerful than a good attitude. If our attitude towards Yahweh and his Torah is right, there's not much in our lives that can be wrong. I mean, that was ultimately what made Dodd righteous. His attitude towards Yahweh and his Torah was right. And no matter what he did in his life, it didn't really matter. Attitude is everything. Our attitude towards God, towards his covenant, is everything that matters. That's why Paul is so toxic. That's why Christianity is so poisonous. And it's why the covenant is so delicious. We'll be back to the final segment of Shattering Myths in a moment. I am Yada, your host. Hello, and welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths. Today we're having a conversation both with Scott, producer of the Shattering Myths program, and with Will, and we came upon this profound concept of changing one's attitude, one's thinking, and one's direction, and how different that is than the religious concept of repenting. I am of the conclusion, Will, that there, if you were to list by most important to least important, the beginning with the most important, things that you can do that will put you at least headed in the right direction to know Yahweh, the one thing that you can do that will best enable you to understand who he is and what he is offering, first and foremost on that list, I would put attitude. Perspective. When you begin to recognize that Yah is nothing more and nothing less than our Heavenly Father, and that everything he has had to say to us is fatherly advice to his children, once you have that attitude towards him, that everything begins to fall into place.
Yes. Oh, I agree with that. You're saying for the attitude for myself, then, or
no? I say for everyone. I'm speaking here. My conclusion, and having studied Yah's word, and I'm still studying it, still learning, that
me too.
That genuinely, if you wanted to take yourself, take me out of it. If you just wanted to isolate, the single most important thing one can do to prepare themselves to know who Yahweh is and understand his teaching, his guidance, his Torah, is to change one's attitude towards him. So that rather than viewing him as a Lord, as someone to be feared, as the God of religion, that you change your attitude and begin to see him as the father of the covenant, and the covenant is nothing more than his family. And when you begin to see God from the attitude of, I am his kid, and he is my dad, that from that point, everything falls into place.
Yes, it does, and that's how I look at myself, is that I am his son, just like Yahusha, but Yahusha is the eldest.
Yes.
He is the eldest. He's the eldest brother, the eldest sibling. So, but yes, I am a son of his, and I hope and I talk with Yah that my rest of my family will come to realization of this. I can't. The only thing I can do for them is talk with Yah and let Yah work in their lives. And have his promise that he will work, and I'll work too, and not be tolerant. He gives me courage more and more too to talk to people, to not tolerate things. And I, like I said, I tell him, you know, it's your attitude, and you need to search things yourself. Don't take my word for it. Don't take any man's word for it. But if you're starting to hear truth from somebody speaking who's studying it, search it yourself. And if you see, oh, he was telling the truth.
Yeah.
And you know, you yourself too.
You begin where you began. The first thing you need to do is change your direction. You've got to question your religion and begin to walk away from it. Question your political allegiances and walk away from them. Question your patriotism and distance yourself from that. To honor the first request of the covenant, which is to walk away from your country. In the case of Abram, it was Babylon, which is the mother of religion and politics and of militarism, of societal customs. And so that's the first thing that God is asking you to do, and it is contained in this Hebrew word sub, which means to change your direction. But beyond that, the thing that you can leave those who are interested in knowing God with is this framework, this perspective. The moment you begin to view God outside of religion, as not as part of a religion, as not a Lord to be worshipped, not a God to be feared, but instead the antithesis of that, as nothing more, nothing less than Dad.
Yeah, if you really think about it, if Yah was wanted us to fear him and want the Lord over us, it would mean he would be pretty petty. You know,
oh, of course, they would. The whole idea of worshiping God says that God is insecure.
Yeah, that's what it would say, and he's not. I mean, if you look at the creation, I tell my grandkids too, I said, if you look at this universe, how it expands and how vast it is, there's no way this came into existence by itself. It has to be intelligently designed. And we have an intelligent father and a very wonderful creator who, it's just mind-staggering. He is mind-staggering. And
who
it's always fun to learn from him.
Who is not insecure. We are at the end of our program today. I want to thank you all for listening and Will particularly for participating.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of young